Hi, and welcome to part two of the Roadwords special. I won't be long introducing it because what it is the full event that took place at the Wanaka Public Library on the 7th of October. You'll first hear Lawrence Patchett introducing us, and then you'll be able to hear the whole event. So I hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
I'm Lawrence Patchett, as you heard. I have written this book, I Got His Blood on Me, which is a book of short stories, and it has, you'll probably get an idea of the character of it from the subtitle, which is Frontier Tales. So I'll read to you from a story called A Hesitant Man, which is about a shipwreck near Wellington. I'll just read the first little couple of sections. I had long been a hesitant man, but now the ship lurched and threw me towards the dark water, and the time for uncertainty, it seemed, was gone. I was on board the Penguin, and she had struck rocks in the night and was going down. In fear and obedience, I'd followed orders to the lifeboats immediately. I had taken my seat and now clutched the wet sleeve of the man next to me. I was no swimmer or boatman and was extremely reluctant to enter the sea, but I swallowed against my fear and prepared to descend. Boarding the Penguin that morning, I'd been in pursuit of a new and bolder future in Wellington. That winter, I'd surprised my landlady and employer by applying for a transfer to the northern office of my firm. Yet I was neither brave nor ambitious, and when I looked into my coming life in Wellington, I saw a secure, if unchallenging, clerkship in an office with good lighting, and at the close of the day, my own unfettered figure walking through dusk to a modest home. With this careful hope, I boarded the steamer at Nelson, nerves cramping my stomach as we traversed the middle space between my old home in the south and my new one. Sitting alone below deck, I was not one of those who understood when the ship struck rocks and tore open some time after dark. But when the crew came through shouting, there was no mistaking their order to abandon ship. When I followed those instructions to the deck, it was straight into a cold clutch of dread and wind spraying over. That ship and that storm was like nothing I had known. Waves slamming the side, and the darkness noisy with wind, and the crew shouting, women screaming. I made my own way as calmly as I could, as what little I knew of emergency told me the most helpful action at such a time was obedience to orders. In this way, I found myself seated in a lifeboat with strange men around me. Our craft was among the first ready, but those with women and children were being given priority. Thus a boat crammed with ladies of all ages and squalling children swung out in the night's buffeting wind and spray. As I watched, it was lowered and lowered and finally touched water and flipped over immediately, hit by a broadsiding wave, the boat spilling into the noisy dark, all its women and children. At this, a stranger at my side groaned and fought free and vaulted to the ship's railing and leapt over. For a moment his shape was silhouetted against the dark, then he was gone. I was dragged to my feet, partly by the man's momentum and partly in alarm. Standing halfway up, I stared after the patch of night into which this husband or father had jumped so unthinkingly. "No, sir," said a voice, "no more. Sit down." I stared. It was the crewman in charge of our lifeboat. "Sit down, sir," he said. "The captain will find him. He'll haul him out, and the others. You stay in the boat, sir. You can't help them." I had no urge to disobey orders, but in shock I remained paralysed, halfway erect and halfway crouching. Beyond the railing, I could hear the woman's cries coming up through the seethe and crash of the sea. "Sit down, sir," said the man. "You're endangering everyone." I sat down. Then our boat was lowering. It was a steep drop from the height of the deck, and the suspenseful vertigo of those hanging moments was dreadful. I felt a hollow in my stomach as we went down, down into darkness, and then we were on the water as it splashed and heaved. For a time, our boat rode the throwing guidance of the swell while a crewman circled his oars, sometimes in water and sometimes in air, the waves falling away beneath the boat as he rowed. I had time to see ahead of me a dark mass of shore before the boat swiveled up a further wave and was flipped over. Then boots and knees were clipping my head as men were thrown across me, and then I was in the plunging water. I had already been wet from the storm, but now I was submerged, and the water was a shocking, cold suck. Thank you.
So something you might not know about Laurie is he's done quite a number of degrees. So honours in literature, MA and PhD in creative writing. And the question it's my turn to ask a question. So the question I wanted to ask was, you probably heard from that story, these stories are full of gripping adventure, but having done all this literary study, I might have expected something else from you, and maybe you were trying to do something else at first, but then you've moved into this just kind of pure storytelling in a way. And so, you know, often there's a conversation about what's literature and what's just telling a story. So can you talk about that? Why, you know, after all that study of all sorts of the kinds of things you studied, maybe you can talk about that and got to this point.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I did a lot of study. There's an intermediate point there that is important. So it came during the MA. I wrote a novel, and it had some strengths, but it also had a weakness, which was that nobody really wanted to read all the way to the end, which is a problem. And the feedback I got was, okay, you're doing character okay and some other aspects okay, but what you need to do is work out how to tell a gripping story, and so I worked on that. And I made it kind of like the number one thing I was trying to do. At the same time, while I was trying to learn how to do that, I read this terrific essay by a writer called Michael Chabon, an American writer. And if I can remember the essay rightly, he was talking about how he loved short stories and he wished they were more popular. I'm the same. But the thing he said was, he studied all these short stories and he thought about it and he was like, I think the reason why people don't read short stories so much anymore is because writers have forgotten that they have to entertain. So, you know, he said that writing at that point had become a bit too sort of caught up in being aesthetic and kind of intensely literary and, you know, all that sort of thing. And so he was saying, we need to entertain people. And so the first way to do that is to write a gripping story. But he was like, but entertainment has a deep and kind of broad definition, and entertainment is includes like a beautiful sentence. You know, when you get aesthetic satisfaction and excitement from reading a beautiful work of art, you know, a beautiful story, that is also entertaining. It's also entertaining when you think about a character or a love story or some kind of relationship that makes you think, that is how the world works, you know, or that helps me to understand the world a bit more. So I was trying to get those three things going. I was trying to get I've said three things, now I can't follow through. Yeah, so I was trying to get a gripping story going, but I was also trying to get depth of character, and I was also trying to create a beautiful work of art. I managed it. There we go. So that's why I sort of went in that gripping story direction, I think. I wanted to make sure people were going to read all the way to the end, but also get other satisfactions from it.
Yeah, and the story's kind of always, not always, but quite often start off with that, like something really kind of dramatic happening, actively happening, and then the rest of the story is the kind of unwinding of that and exploration of that, which is one of those other aspects that you were talking about.
I sort of, I guess a lot of the time I was thinking, how would I cope in this situation? Obviously panic, but how would I sort of try to deal with it? And like for someone like me, I'd blunder through it and then think and talk about it a lot. So that tends to be what happens in my story.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Inga hau wha, tēnā tātou katoa. I'm Tina Marcaretti. So I'm going to read from Where the Record Bones Sings, which is the novel I wrote over the last few years that came out this year. I was trying to think, when did I write it? My other book is Once Upon a Time in Aotearoa, which is a book of short stories, which is actually a little bit difficult to get a hold of now, but I think you can get it on ebook as well. So, yeah, maybe we'll talk more about things after. I'm going to read, I thought it'd be interesting to show you guys a moment in the book where my contemporary characters, I should go back a bit. There's three narratives in the book. There's one section that's set in the 1880s, one in the 1980s, into the contemporary time, and there's a third narrative, which is a spirit figure who's out of time, who was killed in the 1835 invasion of Rīkohu, or the Chatham Islands. I'm going to read from the contemporary section tonight, and so my characters are twins, Lula and Biggs, and they've come to Rīkohu, to the Chatham Islands, to fix up an old family house. And they got Lula, for the first time, is going to meet one of her neighbours. Niko, Kōwhai and Manuka trees surrounded the house, alongside the thick-stemmed flax that grew everywhere. It was a short walk, though even from the top of the hill behind their house, Molly's place was well camouflaged. Close around, the tidy little cottage was white and faded blue. Lula was about to knock when some kind of brindly horse dog appeared around the side of the house and galloped towards her. He stopped short, his head almost reaching her chest, and barked loudly in her face, all teeth and tongue and saliva. "Beast!" The dog immediately put his head down and backed off a bit. A woman appeared around the side of the house. Never mind him. Lovable, really. Knows his job. Doesn't know you. The woman peered at her more closely. "So, are you going to say who you are and what you're doing here?" "Sorry, my name's Lula." She held out her hand. "We're at that old house over there, cleaning it up to sell. We kind of inherited it." "Huh," the woman seemed amused. "Nice. Wondered who it was when I saw all the stuff being delivered. Hasn't been anyone in that house for about 10 years, except some kids every so often. Using it for a party. Chased the last lot off with a few shots when they got too loud." "Right." Lula lowered her hand. She wasn't sure of the appropriate response. "Thanks for that. Are you Molly Tepakari?" The woman looked her up and down. "Did someone say something about me?" "Only that you're the best hunter and fisher around. We were wondering if we might buy some kaimoana from you from time to time." "Ha." Molly shook her head. "No. Nah." Then she turned away and walked around the back of the house again. Beast trotted behind, wagging his tail. Lula didn't know what to do until she heard Molly yelling, "Are you coming or not?" She followed the sound of her voice to a small shed. Meticulously organised traps and nets and fishing gear lined the walls. A huge freezer took centre stage. "This," said Molly, "is the gift of God's abundance. He giveth, he taketh away. Mostly, he giveth and I taketh away." "Used to be I did it for sustenance, but now I seem to do it out of habit. Gotta be useful. Get a few swans. Okay tasting bird. And weka. Bit more tasty. Don't look at me like that. They're not native here, so we try to keep the population in check. The black swans are just pests." She paused and let Beast nuzzle her hand for a head scratch. "Only go fishing once a week, but it's more than one woman can eat. No, you can't buy any. You can have it. Help me by using it up. I try to share it around the ones that don't get out, but there's always so much." Lula didn't know what to do with swan or weka, but she wasn't going to say that to this lady. "Right, take some, there you go. You can come and get some whenever you want. I mean that. Better bugger off then, things to do, places to see." Lula realised she'd been dismissed. "Sorry, Molly, before I go, I was wondering if you might be able to tell me something about our place. Have you lived here long?" "All my life, except for my teens and early 20s. I tried city life, but I couldn't stand it. No time to talk now, though. Isn't the food enough?" Lula blushed. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. If I wanted to talk, I'd live nearer to other people, eh?" "Anyway, welcome to the neighbourhood." Molly started walking away through a field, her beast at her side and a rifle she'd produced from nowhere over her shoulder. Lula was standing by the shed with a dead swan in one hand and a big hunk of groper in the other. Both were as heavy as boulders. She bundled the items together and turned back to the house. They let the swan defrost while they worked. Neither of them knew what to do with it, but Big suggested they boil it for a few hours, throw in some potatoes and whatever else they could find, season heartily. There was mint rampant in the backyard. Swan mint stew. It sounded okay. He was in great spirits. I'm actually going to jump forward in time here a bit. And there's a bit of drama that happens on the island for Lula in particular, and then for Biggs. I won't give that away, but some things have happened. They've encountered some kind of heavy situations. And then there's another scene with Molly in it, and you know, it just shows a different side of her, I think. They came. She didn't know all of their names. They came in utes and trucks, kissed her on the cheek, held her shoulder and pressed their noses to hers. She watched Bigness. She watched Biggs, sorry. The dullness around his eyes, clearing as each one came and embraced him. The lift. By the end, he was focused, looking at each new face, searching. They watched walked through the house, a leader among them speaking in a language that sounded like Māori sometimes, but had sounds and rhythms that were new to her ears. In each room, he sprinkled water. In English, he asked for the house to be cleared of any negative influences and for protection of the inhabitants. Why? She asked Molly. We are nothing to you all. I know we have connections to this place, but it is so small. One ancestor. We can offer nothing. Why have they come? People were setting up kai, eating, talking, teasing. Molly watched the others as she spoke. You see, we are all together today because of you two. They know who you are, even if you don't yet. We recognise you. Not just the way you look, but something else. We don't always look with our eyes. She broke apart a cola shell, sucked flesh from a limb. We are so few. One ancestor? That's one of our dead brought back to life. There are many of us out there roaming the world, but so few at home. You came home, Lula. That's no accident. Here. She passed Lula a piece of tail, then slurped at her own piece. Before you go, there's one more place you should see. Thank you.
Thanks for that reading, Tina. I've got a question for you, and it's sort of one that perhaps at some point all of us have been asked, and that's, people sometimes come up to me at events like this and they say that writing a book is a bit like giving birth. Mm-hmm. And what I always think that is suggested by that is that a book is something that you create and you nurture and then you have to let it go. And I'm just wondering, at what point of your book do you get to the point where you can sort of let it go and move on to the next project, or do you keep wanting to rework it? And
yeah.
And has anybody ever said that writing a book is like a baby to you?
Yeah, it's quite a well-known analogy. I find it quite confusing because I don't feel that way at all. And this took about 3 years, so that would be a very uncomfortable. I can't make it fit in my head. But that comparison, although I understand why people say that, but in terms of letting it go, that's a really good question, because I realise that I don't really feel like it belongs to me at all, and even from the beginning, like I feel like I'm trying to find a way to tell a story that, you know, that belongs to, like, well, this one in particular belongs to several communities. And it's a very imperfect process, so all I can do is kind of find the language to tell the story. But the stories I'm interested in kind of exist in the world already. I feel that's the way I feel. So, I keep working it and reworking it, and it comes out of my head to a certain extent. But kind of my favourite thing about writing is when I don't feel like I have control over the process, and I feel like it's kind of bigger than I am. And I think that makes it easier at the end to kind of go, okay, it's, you know, I've rewritten it this many times now, and it seems to be at a point where the people who read it, because you always have, you know, people looking at the work, kind of, it's working for them, and I don't know, there's a feeling I get
that it can live on its own too.
Yeah.
Stand on its own too.
And that I can't really do anything more. You get to a point where, and also you get to a point where
you're sick of it.
Yeah. You get to a point where, actually, because someone else was asked me a question about whether, about something, oh, should I keep reworking this? And I said, but she said, I don't know how. And I said, when I get to that point, I just let it, that's when someone else can have it. Because if you don't know anything else you can do with it,
yeah. And if you keep working, it becomes kind of the air and the breath, kind of, it's like reworking pastry, or not pastry, but dough, you know, like the air gets out of it and it gets more and more
flat. So
it's more like baking a loaf.
That's a good one. And you know, like, you take your materials for your loaf out of the world and you do something with it, and then it's done. So
less painful. Just slightly less painful.
Well, according to some people would.
Right, thank you. This is made for skinny people to stand behind that. My name's Lawrence. I'm the other Lawrence. And I'm going to read from my new book, which was just launched last week, in fact, and is going to be launched properly in Wanaka on Saturday. So it's lovely to be here. And I'm going to, this book is set in a fictional city called Cook, which is really Wellington. And if you know Wellington at all, it's set on that sort of coastal harbour area as towards Seatoun. So, or if you're coming in on the ferry, it's a sort of the first rocky coast that you come to. And there's three main characters in this book. The main character is a woman called Quinn, and the novel is structured around a countdown to an exhibition she's having. She's an artist and she's working on an exhibition of etchings. She lives with her partner Marcus, who's a vet and who's a keen runner. And so the book is centered around their relationship as well as the art that she's making. And then there's a third character who's kind of a more of a romantic character, and his name is Callum, and he is a deep sea saturation diver who does a lot of work on oil rigs offshore. But when he happens to be back in the country, he lives in a house truck. But the section I'm going to read this evening, which is a section that I wasn't going to read this evening, so Pip's going to be thinking of a new question for me probably, just to keep her on her toes, because if she falls asleep, she'll get it. I get it wrong. So this is, the thing about reading from books is sometimes it's quite hard, because if you have too many characters in the extract, it gets a bit complicated for people who haven't read the book. Quinn arrived early and went through the usual procedure of weighing in, providing a urine sample, and giving a blood sample. When the nurse taking the samples asked how she felt, she replied, "Fine, a bit tired." She explained how she'd been hanging a show for an opening. "Nothing unusual?" asked the nurse. "No," said Quinn. She was told to sit down, and as the doctor wouldn't be long. And it was only then that she began to think about when she had last felt the baby move. She hadn't felt it that morning, but she assumed she had the day before. Yet she wasn't sure. In fact, reconstructing the events of the past few days, she couldn't pinpoint a moment when she had felt a kick, or a flutter, or any movement. She'd been focused on other things, her exhibition and the opening. It wasn't that the baby hadn't moved, she just hadn't been paying attention. At 8:23 a.m. she saw the doctor frown. She had briefly glanced across from the ultrasound screen to the probe crisscrossing his belly, and had seen his hand hesitate. First, she noticed the large digital sports watch on his wrist. Then she looked up in time to catch his expression. Instinctively, she drew a breath and held it, all the time feeling her heart beat more and more frantically in her chest. She didn't know where to look. The screen, his face, the probe, the screen, the LED on his watch pulsing 8:25 as she tried to maintain focus. She attempted to speak, but her mouth was dry. And when the words came out, they were cracked and broken, crushed like broken glass. Death and kindness are both silent. She was given her own room at the hospital. From time to time, a nurse would enter the room and touch her oh so gently on the arm or stroke her hair. One enfolded her in her arms when she sobbed. Another held her hand and whispered, "You brave, brave girl," as she was induced. An hour into labour, and Quinn's brain and logic gave way. She knew the baby was dead. There was no heartbeat. If she gave birth now, at 19 weeks, the baby wouldn't survive. It would die. She must keep the baby safe, protect it, keep it safe inside her. The baby was dead. These thoughts circled her mind around and around, and nothing made sense. She screamed when the baby was born. The baby was silent. She didn't know who to call, so she had the nurse phone her art dealer, Bernard. He arrived in an immaculate three-piece suit, carrying a leather overnight bag. He was dignified and solemn and sat in silence, waiting until she was ready. He was simply there with her. They opened the bag together. Inside was a camera, an oak-coloured pashima, a cream-knitted cap, and a tiny newborn-sized stretch and grow that was grotesquely large. He watched and assisted as Quinn dressed her daughter. He apologised for not having thought to bring his antique lace christening gown, but added that the baby looked beautiful just as she was. It was the first, last, and only time that Quinn dressed her daughter, and she worried that the knitted cap would scratch and irritate her baby's scalp. She thought the clothes were all wrong, but didn't know what to do. It was just that the child was so small, only a few inches longer than her hand, and the clothes seemed to swallow her up. Quietly, Bernard suggested they could swaddle the baby in the pashima. It was cashmere and it wouldn't hurt her child. Quinn nodded, and carefully they undressed her daughter and covered her in the soft fabric. Quinn breathed a sigh of relief. Frightened of crushing her daughter, she had to be reassured before she would take her back in her arms and cradle her while Bernard took a photo. Her baby was too small and so fragile. A nurse described her as an angel, but Quinn replied that her proportions and the size of her eyes were more in keeping with a fledgling fallen from a nest. The nurse looked startled, then nodded and left the room. Bernard asked if she would like him to take some more photos, and she nodded. Once again, they uncovered the baby, lowering her gently onto the pashima on the bed, while Bernard silently took image after image. When he had finished, he lowered the camera and stepped out of the room, leaving Quinn alone with her child, while he went and consulted with the hospital staff about what to do next. Quinn whispered as she caressed her daughter. Her skin had a translucent sheen and was so thin that parts of her body were marble blue. Her eyelids, which were closed, were almost transparent. Quinn touched her fingers, held one tiny hand in her own, and began to shake. Her body rocked back and forth as she howled and shook and begged her daughter to come back to give her another chance. She promised to do better, that she would never, ever, ever miss another appointment, no matter what. She would just come back. She held her in her arms and rocked back and forth, repeating the words, "Sorry, sorry, 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 sorry," pleading with her to breathe. She pressed her ear to her daughter's chest, thought she felt some movement, and smiled. She called out for Bernard, who came hurrying back with the nurse. "I felt her move," said Quinn. "She moved." She looked from Bernard's concerned face to the nurse's, but no one smiled. "Quinn," began the nurse, but Quinn wouldn't listen. She had felt the baby move. And then it was all over. At some point, and Quinn is not sure when, she let her daughter go. She watched as she was taken from the room. At the very moment that she lost sight of her child, she heard a baby cry, a long cry that slowly faded away. Thanks.
Thanks, Lawrence. I want to ask something around the idea of not looking away. Like, I want to think about... once I wrote a story and someone said to me, "Why would you want to write about that?" You know, like, whoa, you know, and, you know, why don't you write about something happy? And I just wonder what happens what happens in a book when you don't look away. Like, I know what happens to me as a reader when you don't look away, when you stay and stay and stay and stay. And that's what that scene seems to do. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There's lots of opportunities to let us off the hook, but yeah. It just stays and stays. And I know what that does to me as a reader. You know, it's compelling. I feel, which is huge. But I'm just wondering, can you talk about
yeah.
Is there any kind of question?
I mean, that's a difficult scene to talk about. And the reason why it's difficult, I guess, is because I have no experience of miscarriage. So I had to research miscarriage, and I wanted it to be... The whole reason for having this miscarriage at 19 weeks was because that's the kind of limit before it becomes stillbirth.
Mm.
And I was interested in the way that people can go, oh, it was just a miscarriage, and kind of dismiss it as if it's not important. So the first way that I didn't want to look away was I wanted to make people read the book and go, miscarriage is pretty real, you know.
Mm.
And then and getting into that character. And as I was writing it, often when you're writing, I don't know if this happens to you guys, but sometimes when your writing makes you laugh or it can make you actually cry.
Mm.
And when I was writing this, like sometimes I feel as if I've written a decent scene if I'm crying at the end of it.
Mm.
And that scene made me cry when I wrote it. So I thought, well, that's probably okay. And there's another scene in the book that made me cry, which has nothing to do with miscarriage. But that thing of looking away, that's a tricky one, isn't it? I think that goes with the style of writing that I'm interested in. I think probably with writers, I tend to simplify things because I don't like clutter. So in my life and all those sorts of things. And I think there's two kind of styles of writing, and this is simplifying, generalizing. I think there's some writers who write and they layer upon layer upon layer, so they obscure the core of the story, and they create interest through these different layers and levels. And then there's writers like me who create a story by taking off layer after layer after layer, and they want to reveal the core.
Mm.
And I think that looking away question is very much related to the way I write, which is that idea of layering, taking off the layers to get to the core, rather than building up layers to create a bigger, sort of more obscured, technical, you know, intellectual kind of writing. So that's the only way I can really answer that question.
I think that's a really good answer. And you know, that idea of taking away layers also makes me think of that idea of rawness as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that works in well with that scene.
I really love rawness.
Mm, me too.
And it can be, when you get down to that level and it's either that rawness where it's humiliating and you've sort of got crying and snots coming out of your nose. I think that's the kind of feeling I want to get with my writing, that is stripped back and you're standing naked kind of writing.
Mm.
But it's not the kind of writing that everybody does, yeah, fortunately.
I'm going to go and stand over here now.
Kia ora tātou, my name's Pip Adam. I just wanted to, while we're here, Lawrence talked about her launch, which is part of this amazing thing that's coming out this weekend. Everyone will be there. You're so lucky. It will be incredible. So Lawrence's book, there's going to be a launch for it at 4:15 on Saturday. And it's going to be launched with Ian Wedde's new memoir, The Grass Catcher. So it'll be an amazing event. And it's directly after this amazing event. It's just, yeah, basically just get yourself seated and don't leave. It'll be incredible. That'll be amazing. Yeah, so my name's Pip Adam. I wrote this book, which is called Everything We Hope For, which is a collection of short stories. And then I wrote this book, which is called I'm Working on a Building, which is an earworm if you like Elvis, but if you don't like Elvis, you'll be all right. This is a book about engineers. It's a book about structural engineers and buildings. Each chapter is centred around the building. But the piece that I'm going to read today is actually about a hairdresser. The main character of the book is called Catherine, and she's an engineer, she's a structural engineer, and her sister Isabel works as a hairdresser. Her younger sister Isabel works as a hairdresser, and this chapter is told from Isabel's point of view. So Isabel is the eye that you'll meet in a minute. And the reason I wanted to read about hairdressers today is that at the moment I'm writing another novel which is about hairdressing. So I just wanted to see how the hairdressing stuff sounded in the world. And as we meet, the day that this is all happening on is a busy day in the salon. Isabel is not a young hairdresser. Isabel is about, I imagine her about 40 years old, 42 years old. She's been hairdressing for a really long time. And it's her mother's birthday. Her mother's birthday is coming up, which she's forgotten about. But her sister Catherine, who's engineering at the moment in Germany, has not forgotten and has contacted her about it. This is called Platt & Boulton. The reason it's got the name is because Catherine is in Germany at the moment taking down some of the huge apartments that were put up during the east-west part of it. So, Joan Kalman was late. Scott and I stood behind the reception desk looking at the computer screen. There was nothing else we could do and he was angry. It was 4 o'clock on a Friday and she was already 15 minutes late. Maybe she won't turn up, I said, looking at the train wreck that was more and more likely every minute we weren't cutting and colouring Joan Kalman's hair. Scotty was scrolling back and forward over our names on the screen. He highlighted the letters of mine in groups so they read Isabel over and over. It was usually a friendly thing, an in-joke, but today it seemed agitated and bitter. He shook his head and said, she's always late. Isabel. I could do Kate Delaney's foils before you cut her. Scott shook his head again. It wouldn't work. I knew that, but sometimes it looked like Scott didn't want it to work. Like by it not working, by us running round all night, hearts beating, arms aching, it would somehow punish Joan Kalman and she would never be late again for anything. The door opened and it wasn't her. The salon was getting loud. Everything echoed off the wooden floors and walls. Danny dropped some tint bowls in the sink. Willow was stomping about in her big boots, looking for her sectioning clips. Jodie shouted that she had them. Sorry! The room hummed with smiles and staunchness and loud music. Bonnie strode to Willow's station, well ahead of the woman whose hair she'd just washed. She beat her there by a distance and was left standing with her hands on the chair resting while the woman made her way. For that time, the salon echoed loudly with her resting, and it echoed with me and Scott standing uselessly at the reception desk. I could talk her into a full head colour, I said. It was a stupid suggestion. Scott was so angry, and then he said it. What they tell us to say, so we think more highly of ourselves, so we make more money, and in the fire of him standing there waiting and waiting, like somehow it helped him feel worse about it, Scotty said it. And it still meant the nothing we all knew it meant, but he said it and it sounded even more stupid in the saying than it did in our heads. She wouldn't do it to her dentist. They've been saying it to us for all our careers, and even now after 20 years of hairdressing, they were still saying it. At every management conference we went to, be more like dentists, they said, because you aren't important enough as hairdressers. Maybe she would, I said, maybe she's like that. I could feel Scotty bristling, and they also tell us to pick our battles, so I said, but if she did, they'd charge her for it. They tell us to say that as well. So we feel like professionals, so we'll act like professionals, inflexibly. Joan Kalman came in the door. She was in a flap, and we both apologised to her, and I took her coat and made her a coffee, and Scotty washed her hair and cut it fast, in a way that made her think he was taking all the time and care in the world. And halfway through, his 4:15 arrived and he shouted, "Hi, Yen!" And as I was taking Yen's coat, Scott came over and said, so no one could hear the energy in his voice, "Joan's ready now, Isabel." And it was beautiful. And we were back. And there was a chance once again that we wouldn't piss anyone off and that we would finish eventually. Bonnie swept the hair from around Joan Kalman, who looked down from her seat and said, "He didn't take much off. It looks great though," I said, and ruffled her fringe. The large, expensive silver bracelets on my wrist clapped together. The heavy rings I wore snapped. "Doesn't it look great?" She smiled. "It's great," she said, touching the nape where her dark blonde hair tapered neatly into her neck in perfectly disordered wisps. like God put them just like that, I thought. I dried her hair off quickly, sectioning up and started applying the foils. She continued to read her magazine, which was fine with me. Occasionally she would comment on the pictures, "Isn't she stunning? Hasn't she put on weight? What's he doing with her?" I knew all of the people she pointed to. This one was an All Blacks wife, but I hadn't watched rugby for years. This one was a finalist in a TV show that was on while I was working. But I knew them. I also knew the score in the cricket. I can look interesting when I'm not paying the tiniest bit of attention. I can be counting almost every single strand of hair on someone's heads, but I can hear them and I can nod. I can watch what their faces do and I can do it, and I can laugh when they joke, and sometimes I'm funny too, but generally I'm intimidating. That's what time gives you, an air of ownership over the space you take up, over the work you do. Joan Kalman looked stunning. So did Odin, so did Yen. They all looked stunning. And at 9:30 they were all gone. They were all gone. Scotty let out a long sigh as he shut the door on the last of them. Willow started balancing up the till, and he looked at my phone, and I looked at my phone. "What's the time in Berlin?" Scotty asked. I smiled at him. He thinks I have a lover. That's how much we don't listen to each other. As the till spat out of a printout, and Willow asked if anyone wanted a wine, I checked the time again. I made it mid-morning in Berlin now. I got my cigarettes out of my bag and took my phone outside. "I'll do those in a minute," I said to Bonnie, who was looking at the pile of Joan Kalman's foils that I'd left in the sink. She was trying to clean some tint bowls and brushes. I knew it pissed her off. She'd probably whinge about it to Scotty, and then Willow would find out, and there would be an item at the staff meeting about seniors helping juniors and not expecting them to clean up everything. It would be annoying, but for now it seemed worth it. I was gagging for a smoke, and I might catch Catherine on her cell phone. It would give Bonnie something to do, something to talk about. Being an apprentice could be boring, especially after high school. I almost said that to her, but I couldn't look at her screwed up little face any longer. Outside it was dark and cold. The salon was in a low building in an alley off High Street between three tall buildings. I could hear people in Queen Street and Vulcan Lane beyond the buildings that boxed us in. Even now and then, one of them would shout out. I leaned against a wall, so I was out of sight of the salon, and lit a cigarette. I rang Catherine and she picked up. It was loud where she was, and she had to talk louder than she normally did so I could hear her. "That's 7 a.m. here," she said, when I asked her about the birthday dinner and maybe we could Skype call for Mum. "Is it?" I said. "It's 12 hours, Isabel, and a day behind." "What time is it now?" I said. "It's about 9:30 in the morning." "Where are you?" It sounded like a bar. "At a meeting." "Is it a nice day?" "Isabel, I'm at a meeting." "Oh, sweet. Sorry." We were both silent for a moment. I could hear the noise rising behind her, then it would subside. It was like waves on a beach. It didn't sound like a meeting. "So what if we stay up later?" I said. Could we call you at 10 or 11? "Call after dinner," she said. I could tell she was talking to someone else, making hand signals to them, mouthing the words. "Okay," I said, "tell them that." I'll tell them that. "Did you get the book?" she said, "for the present." "I got her shampoo," I said. "Isabel, you always get them shampoo. Get her a book." I looked out at the dark streets. Nothing was open. "Get her the book, Isabel." Thank you.
Thanks very much for that reading. That's wonderful. I guess the question I'm interested in to ask you is one that's been bothering me for a while. It's about voice. And because the thing is, I've been reading Pip's work for ages, and I've always admired it. And one of the things that I really admire about it is that she's innovative and very daring. You heard Pip mention that this new book is about engineering, and that's a challenging thing to write about. I would find in fiction, and you try to write about it in a new way, which is makes for even more of a challenge. But I think, earlier I was saying I go for something simple in fiction, which is like. I'm trying to get people into the book straight away, you know, introduce the central character right at the start, get them on a gripping story, that'll be sweet, just leave it at that. Whereas Pip's more about, like, I think you might be more about, like, sometimes disrupting reader expectations, challenging them, things like this. And so, when I was reading your book the second time, the new book, I noticed that the things that I would try to do, like get the central character into the story very early, things like that, wasn't happening. I had to wait until about the 7th page to meet the central character, but I was absolutely gripped by it. I was really riveted. And so I was wondering, is that a technique of voice? I guess I'll just quickly say what I see as voice. Mm-hmm. Voice is all those techniques that we use that add up to make the sound a writer makes on the page, like the rhythms they use, the sentence length, the tone. And I was thinking, is it voice that Pip's using to keep me engrossed in this story? It's quite a difficult question, but I'm asking, like, did you consciously use voice in that way, or was it something a bit more organic?
Sounds really important for me, like the way things sound. Like, that was largely why I went to engineering, because I fell in love with words like moment resisting frame and the thrust, the up thrust of things. And it's a very sexy language. If you ever get to hang out with a structural engineer, things are always coupling into each other. So the sound of it was really exciting to me. And I think it made a noise in my head. I come from, my father's a musician, and like my brothers, I just have all these musicians in my family. All I wanted to be was a musician, and I'm tone deaf. It's often about the noise that it's making, and I think in that way it is about voice, you know what I mean? Like, I think in those first 7 pages that you're talking about, I sort of saw those as, like, I don't know much about opera. There's probably people that know way more about opera in the room, but my understanding is, like, I went and saw Eugene Onegin, and there's a little noise that it keeps making throughout. that's technical. There's a little noise that it keeps making throughout the opera, like, and I felt like those first 7 pages were to say, watch out, this is the noise this book makes, before I introduce the character, if you know what I mean. Like, to sort of say, it was kind of like that. Not so much the orchestra warming up, but it was like, you know, in those operas that I've seen, there's often music before people sing, and that was kind of what I was thinking about. And, you know, I mean, voice is really interesting, because that the book's called I'm Working on a Building. The only people that have first-person chapters in there are not engineers and don't work on buildings. So, yeah, like, it's kind of, that was why the title appealed to me when it was suggested. So yeah, I think as far as noise goes, it is a tick of voice. Yeah.
But the building's a character.
Yeah.
So the building gets introduced earlier. So if you saw Pitt's book as being where the buildings are characters, then the character kicks in really quickly.
That's true. Yeah. I was reading it in the way, I guess, like, yeah, I was looking for a human.
Yeah, my books never look for humans. It's always the animals and the inanimate objects.
That's terrific. This is a good moment to ask whether anybody else wants to ask a question. If not, I have other questions. Yeah, please.
It's interesting that you've all written New Zealand books based in New Zealand, and I wondered, Lawrence, with your short stories, are all your short stories New Zealand based, or are they based somewhere else, or?
Yeah, there's only one in this book that isn't. It's set in Australia during the Depression, about endurance swimming, which I got interested in for some reason. But
it's got New Zealand characters.
It does, yeah, it does feature a New Zealand character who actually came third in that competition, this fantastic swimmer, a Ngāpuhi woman from up in Northland. So there's only one story that's not set in New Zealand. I did try to write a story. I'm a big fan of westerns, and I think a lot of the time I was just trying to write a western. And at one point I tried to write one set in Montana, and it involved like cattle and things like that, and it was terrible. And I was like, let's include this story, and my editor was kind of like, yeah, let's not. Yeah. But for me, I think All the books that I love most are set in New Zealand. I mean, I read from all over, but I'm about reading New Zealand fiction, I think.
Pip's stories aren't all set in New Zealand.
No. Mine are in North Korea. There's one in the Ozarks in the States. There's Berlin. But I do like New Zealand as well.
It's a good question, though.
It's a good question. Have you lived in those countries?
Not at all, no. I'm really interested in the way that I have these imaginary countries that I carry with me, if you know what I mean. Like, you know, like I was brought up on American culture, and I always felt like I knew what a diner would be like. And then when I went to the States and went to a diner, I was like, whoa, this is different to the one I've got in my head. So I do like to write about places I haven't been. That's why I was interested in North Korea, because I knew three people that had been, and that was all. You know, it wasn't, it's very hard to find information about North Korea, so it was nice because it seemed like a place that I could have an imaginary North Korea. Yeah, but yes.
Sorry, I've got a question for the lady on the second from the right. I'm really sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Yeah.
Hi. You were saying at the start how when you're writing a book, you sort of trust to the process, and you just sort of, well, the impression I got was sort of let the book take you where it's going.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, does that lead you to sort of a lot of false starts where you have maybe a preconceived or a half an idea of a character and you've started to write the book, and then all of a sudden it or the character, he or she, takes you somewhere where maybe you didn't anticipate, and then all of a sudden you thought maybe at the beginning you had a book, and now all of a sudden you don't, because it's just gone in such a totally different direction.
It's a good question. They definitely take you places you don't expect. The thing I'm working on at the moment, I was thinking something was going to happen, and it was going to happen this way, and then the character's talking to another character, and then suddenly he's talking about Barbados, and I thought, I don't know anything about Barbados, because at some point in the novel he's going to get shipwrecked there, but I don't want him talking about it at the start, but that's what he wants to do, so it makes me then go, I've actually left a gap and gone on. But it does make me go, I like to follow what the character is doing, and that's never put me wrong when they start taking over. What does not work for me is the contemporary section of this book I rewrote in full 3 times, and when I say I rewrote in full, like I'm always rewriting kind of constantly, but like I had to start again with a new name for the characters, and it was because they weren't real to me yet, like in my imagination, and so because they weren't fully formed, they didn't lead me in the right direction, because I was kind of moulding it into what I thought the story should be. For some reason the kind of consciousness of that doesn't really work for me. I have to kind of let go a bit, and then because, I mean, where creativity comes from is
it's like you have to learn your characters, don't you? Like,
yeah.
Do you find that you often rewrite, like you start writing a book and then about, let's say a book's 250 pages, say 50 pages in, that's when you start learning who your characters are. And so you often end up rewriting the first part of your book a lot more than the last parts of your book?
Sometimes, and I think you were talking about thinking about a book for a year before you write it, and what happened for me was that I realised that I just hadn't let that sit for long enough. Like, sometimes if you can write it and have lots of false starts, but also if you're forced to just think about it for a long time because you're doing other things, often then you get to the right character comes up, but if you're trying to force it, then you might often do that. You might take you a while to figure out who the character is. And I was trying to force the contemporary stuff, so it wasn't ready.
First of all, thanks for those delightful excerpts from your writing. But you obviously write for yourselves, but that's an inevitable path to starvation, I guess. who is the audience? Who's there behind the screen or behind the page that you got in mind as you write your stories?
Should we just go? Start with you,
Millionaires.
Millionaires, yeah. Also disposable income. I get really... Lawrence and I were talking about this today. I get very self-conscious if I start to think about anyone reading the book, because I think writing is an odd thing to do. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm playing with my imaginary friends, you know, like, and so I don't know. Like, I have an idea. Once the book's written, there are certain people who I'm extremely excited about if they give me positive feedback. So, yeah, I'm not the best person to talk, because I, like I say, like, if I ever, like,
I was just thinking, like, Vladimir Nabokov, there was an unfinished book which he asked no one to, you know, he asked for it to be destroyed. And I often feel I never want anyone to read it unless I'm giving it to them in a very controlled way. Yeah, that doesn't answer your question. You'll be better at that.
I think that point about being very self, I think if you think about anybody reading your book when you're writing it, it does make you a very self-conscious writer, because then you're trying to think if you're going to please them, or you start second guessing, and then you think it just gets, it's too difficult to think of that next step, I think. So you just, this is my ninth book, so if I'm writing a book, I'm still writing for myself, and I'm hoping that somebody who might have read one of my other books might have a taste for my writing, in which case they will read this book. But I'm not thinking of writing I'm not thinking of writing to an audience. I'm just thinking of finishing a book.
Yeah. You know, I write for, it sounds terribly self.
It does, but
I write for myself, mainly because that's what produces good writing for me. Like, if I'm bored, I don't expect anyone else not to be bored. Like, I have to write something that I'm interested in to keep writing. And the times where I've gotten bored by my own writing, I usually end up throwing that out at some stage. So it has to be, like, kind of interesting for me to actually produce the work. And then I kind of want to write for someone that's interested in the same problems that I'm interested in. But that's why it's good to have lots of different writers and lots of different types of writers, because they've got different obsessions and ways of doing things. So, yeah, I think that's the only way I can think of doing it.
Yeah, I definitely echo what you three have said. And it particularly struck me, that phrase you used, you're just thinking about finishing a book. For me, that is an enormous challenge. I'm very much just focused on, when I'm writing the book, I'm just focused on the craft and trying to keep it gripping, and that sort of deep entertainment that I talked about. And I suppose if I ever think of people who might read it, I guess I would think of the people who, you know, said you need to learn how to write a gripping story. Sometimes I do think about, in my weaker moments, I guess, or when I'm editing or something, when I'm thinking about the book and as a whole, like, say if I'm later on in the process, I sometimes think about a teacher I had back in Christchurch, you know, 15 years ago, and going like, I hope he thinks that's good. Mm-hmm. But then he probably doesn't read it anyway. But I definitely echo what was said.
One of the pleasures I get from reading books is I feel as if I'm sitting beside the author while they're processing the thought that is driving what they're writing. And I've often wondered, what is it that drives a writer to write about something that is not actually within their own experience? And you were not present at the wreck of the penguin, even though it was a factual thing. I'm not sure how much you experienced about the Chatham Island. Lawrence, you've been writing about things that you haven't actually experienced yourself, and Pip, I'm not that familiar with your writing, but don't actually envisage you working in a hairdresser's shop.
I was a hairdresser for 15 years. I'm very old.
But there's a lot more in your writing.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, that's just the sight of the story. So what is it that drives you to, that it inspires you to write about something?
It's a niggle.
Yeah,
you'll get an idea. It's curiosity and then something that just niggles, isn't it? Do you think?
I'm always trying to work out. What happens for me is something will happen in the world that I don't understand. It's usually, like, I do a lot of work out at the prison at Arahata, and I'll see something and I won't understand. I'll just be like, why? I don't understand this about society. And then I'll search out a situation where I can do a thought experiment on why we might do that. Is it, you know, why humans might do that. And like you say, it niggles and niggles and niggles. And then I'm just, curiosity and niggling. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, that's my, you said my thing, like at the moment I'm trying to figure out something about a person who was exhibited in 1840s, but it's really trying to figure out something about our culture and what, because it's the same culture, and we do that now. We put people on television or on the internet and we exploit people. Mm-hmm. It's really about that, but on the stories in the 1840s mm-hmm. in Victorian London, mm-hmm. but that's where we all come from and where our culture comes from, I mean, to a certain extent.
Western
culture. So, yeah, trying to figure out, like, and yeah, so it's always a big question, isn't
it? But sometimes it isn't even, you don't start with a story. Like, the novel I'm thinking about writing next, the thing that's niggling me is just I want to write a novel that has a very strong sense of the demarcation line between light and shade. Mm. And that will be the opening, that's the thing that's pressing against me, that I want to write this novel. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, on a very, like, noon on a very sunny day when you get, like, a building casting a very sharp shadow and then the burning light in the sun. Mm-hmm. And that's all that will be niggling me for about a year, and then the whole novel will be built around that. But somebody reading the novel would think that it was a story about something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
yeah.
That
seemed
to. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, it's about anxiety. this is a book all about, it's full of anxiety. What tends to happen, I get an idea for a story, I sort of get that early process that the guys were talking about, but then as I figure out what it's about and what I want the characters to worry about, then that's when I put my own anxiety into the story and I ask them to figure it out for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember this happening a lot when I was becoming a step-parent for the first time, and I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? And then so it's kind of like, what are all the things that can go wrong? Put them into a story and see how the character copes. It's kind of funny. It's always like...
Was it a short story or a long story?
I have this feeling that I revealed too much just then. But yeah, it's kind of that for me. It's that, like, sending your imagination forward quite often into a borderland that you're worried about. Another time, it was like I was reading history, a lot of history in the history of our area, and I started noticing that I was really interested in kind of like the conflicts and the things that were bloody, and like I was like, oh, this is cool, I want to read about this. And then I was like, what is it in me that's making me read history that way, and why do I always go to, you know, the most violent, or like seek out the characters in history at a certain point in contact who weren't kind to each other? Because I imagine that most of history was about people reaching out to each other in the way that we do now. But I was going, oh, where's the blood, you know? And I wanted to figure out what that was about, so I wrote stories about that. Yeah. So it's about anxiety for me. Yeah, we've gone a little bit over time. If there are... one more.
Last one. You mentioned about thinking about how to finish a book. My question's more about how to start the book and about motivation. And I guess I like what you said about writing something that is a gripping yarn and has depth of character and has aesthetic beauty. And I like to do all of those, but I've done none of them. And so I guess my question is, to everyone, if they had the secret or the silver bullet rules, how you go about the process. Like, do you set yourselves a time in the morning when you write, or do you wait till you've got a burning desire, or not having waited 35 years to address the niggle, but it hasn't been addressed, and so I'm just interested if there's a secret.
Turn the inner critic off until you've done the first draft. Yeah. And force yourself to write. It's like, just think of something else that you really hate, like exercise that you do, or go to work that you do, or do the lawn mowing that you do, and it's just another chore that you've got to do.
And you make yourself do it, eh?
Yeah,
you make
just,
time.
Just think of it as a chore that needs doing, and there's no escape. And once you've done it, the sooner you get it done, the sooner you can do something else.
Yeah.
So do it in the morning, and that's how it works.
Because some of us have hours that we do, and some of us have words, like I drip. I try to do the same as Lawrence, which is 1,000 words a day when I'm working on something.
Right.
1,000 words a day.
And if you do it, then you're free to do something.
You don't feel guilty the rest of the day.
Yeah,
guilt's a good one.
I was just thinking,
like, seriously.
I always think of that story about Chekhov, how he lived in that tiny house with all his relatives, and he was a doctor all day, and he would come home, and while they were partying, he'd sit at the end of the dining table writing. Mm-hmm. And I just think that, and I think about William Carlos Williams, how he would write in between, you know, like, he was a doctor as well, and the patient would come in, he'd see them, and I just think it's those gaps as well. Like, you know, sometimes I can get some good work done in 10 minutes, you know what I mean? Like, sometimes when my life's really busy, and I think that once it's down, I can then, especially when I had a small daughter, I could write it down, and while I'd be pushing a pushchair, I'd be thinking, oh, I wonder what Catherine would think of that, or I wonder what Tiny would think of that, or, and I think, you know, like, definitely, it's just, the worst surprise I got when I was about 18 years old, when I'd been swanning around in black clothes for centuries, saying I was a poet, was that writers write, you know what I mean? Like, it was like, oh, that's how you write a book, you write, and,
For me, it's a mixture of having fun and taking it seriously.
Yeah.
And I take it way too seriously. But going back to the having fun, the reason why I went to it in the first place is because I absolutely love books. And I loved reading stories when I was a kid. And when I first started writing, it's because I was just like, I want to see what happens, you know. But also, I had these big ideas, you know, oh, I'm going to be a writer. But then I like. In a different way from Pip, but I didn't do anything about it for years and years, until I was about 30. It's taken me a while to get going even after that. But anyway, the point is, for me, when I first really got going, I was like, I'm just going to see, turn the inner critic off, as Lawrence said, and I just was like, I just want to see what happens, you know, because it'll be fun. And I had a boring job at the time, and I was like, anything could be better than that. And so I did that, but then as I sort of worked on it a bit more, and I continued to have fun with it, go various places, I started to take it seriously, and now what I find helps me the most is I treat it like a job. Mm. And like other jobs, I can have a good day and a bad day, but on a good day, it's really fun. And on another day, on a bad day, I'll still turn up and try, you know? And so for me, those two things have really helped. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. But I do treat it like a job because it kind of is my second part-time job, but it doesn't pay.